Are you feeling overwhelmed? Do you need a more flexible schedule? At the Athabasca University has you covered. AU offers over 850 online courses designed to fit your needs. That's 850 opportunities to earn credits that seamlessly transfer back into your program. Improve your GPA, explore new subjects, and study from anywhere. Visit athabascau.ca to browse our online courses and transform your academic journey.
And welcome. It's just a few seconds after 4 o'clock this afternoon. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. Coming up on the show today in the first hour, from a July 11th book launch and reading event at Novel Idea Bookstore, you'll hear Spencer Gordon launching his new book, A Horse at the Window. And joining him as guest readers that evening were Kingston Poet Laureate Sadiqa DeMeyer, Nancy Jo Cullen, Bruce Geddes, and me. This does run a few minutes into the second hour. And so in that second hour and beginning, then after, you'll hear another book launch event held July 24th, again at Novel Idea, as Deborah Kimmett launches her Window Shopping for God, both in her reading from it and in conversation with Len Whalen. Just the usual start of the hour announcement, though, occasionally some spoken word music or poetry played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. And let's just go ahead and jump right into that July 11th book launch and reading event at Novel Idea.
Are you guys ready? You guys ready for the most electrifying night in literary entertainment? What we... So we, as we put this little night together, we forgot to figure out an MC, and we forgot to put together like bios and introductions and the standard tissue that like connects a reading. So I'm just gonna say hi. Thank you so much, all of you, for coming. My name is Spencer, and a few months ago, I put this together and asked some people in Kingston area, to come join me for the launch of my third book, A Horse at the Window, from House Financy. I'm super deeply grateful for those readers for joining me tonight. And I hope it's a lovely night for all of you and you enjoy the refreshments that Novel Idea has laid out. And thanks so much to Novel Idea, wherever they are. In the walls. Yeah, and so in lieu of bios and introductions, we're gonna do like two sets. So a first set of like three readers and then do a short break to get another drink or use washroom or go outside or do whatever you need to do. And then after 5 to 10 minutes or so of that short break, we'll come back with two more. Okay, without further ado, what we'll do, I suppose, through this night is we'll just like set up the reader after us for all of us. And that person can kind of introduce themselves and what they're up to, some of the works they've completed, etc. Does that make sense? Okay. Thank you. So the first reader we have tonight is Kingston's own Bruce Coffey.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for the nice crowd you drew here tonight. So it's a wonderful crowd. Thanks to Novel Idea for always everything they do for the community. And thank all of you for coming out to support his launch and to hear some Kingston readers as well. For those that don't know me, I'm Bruce Kaufman. This was my latest collection of poetry that came out last year, just over a year ago. And my fifth collection. I host a radio show and also a monthly open mic, so we'll let it go at that. And I'm going to read two newer pieces, and then I'm going to read some very short pieces out of this collection. First poem is called In Our Haste, What We Forget. I was sitting in a not crowded movie theater, still waiting for the show to begin. The usual perfunctory screens of slogans and messages about the lobby, concession stand, where the trash receptacles were, upcoming films and extra attractions, went off to the side with the lights now gently dimming, I watched someone come in. And in this near dark now, they slow walking their way up the stairs to their row. And what amazed me, that from their chest was a soft glowing light, as if emanating from within. For several seconds, I sat astonished as that glow never went away. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw a young child also watching that person. I looked over, said to them, in just above a whisper, "Did you see that light too?" They turned to me, as if almost surprised that I would ask, and said, "Yes, I did. And I do, sir. Just like I saw everyone else's as they came in. Yours too. I see it in everyone and everything, just like everyone else does, all the time." And then the child looked at me straight in the eye, said, "And I believe you, sir, used to see it that way, too." This is called Moon. I'd mentioned as I sat down in a crowded room that on my way there that early evening, I'd been enthralled watching a sliver of a crescent moon. Said while sitting there, it was my favorite moon. You, I'm sure, helpfully and compassionately reminded me when you said, "There is really only one moon." I said something after that was silly or nonsensical, simply to end that tiny conversation. That crowded room that night was overly vibrant, loud, dozens of conversations rolling over the tops of each other, competing for space, with its even much too loud music on top of that. That small space that evening was with too many people, too much noise, was not the place to talk about the whispers of the moon or how fragile it is. That evening, it neither waxing nor waning, but weeping instead. Unfinished notes from a journal number 6. July 2019. There is a melancholy rain outside my window this evening, and I realize as I write that I hold an unguided pen in my right hand. Its ink as fragile as it is indelible. A crossing in a city. As you and I stand downtown at an intersection, two main streets crossing, cars, trucks, buses, in all their colors pass by, swarms of pedestrians in their slow crawl on either side. You watch, transfixed by it all, its flowing colors and shapes and voices. I look at you, smiling, embracing it all, and I want to tell you how foreign all of this is to me. but cannot. I stand here with but a language you have already forgotten. An offering. Not a prayer. Simpler, perhaps. A statement, request, a word of thanks to God or gods, energy or universe, to a wavering agnostic belief, to that spirit of endless time without time, to the known, the knowing, the unknowing, the unknowable, to softness in a world of too little of it. Difference. Of profound difference. Asked to sit and when prompted then to either create a poem or allow one. Opt for the latter. And there become not the poet. Instead, the ink, the page. An empty journal. In an overcrowded cafe, I reach into my knapsack, pull out this new journal, crack its spine open the first time. It is as new as this day. While this day today only appears to be a photocopy, carbon copy of all the days before, this day instead unique, one in all lifetimes, and it too as crystalline as its memory soon will be. And I just have two poems left. Thank you for your attention. For 30 days, make a commitment to write a short poem a day, and after 7 days, double it. And make it happen. Better still, simply know it will. Do not feel anxious when you begin each day. Do not feel guilty on an evening you fail, but do it still for 30 days. And on the 31st, call me. Tell me how much your life has changed. My final poem is Sounds in Silence. A shout will last as long as its own voice and breath in that instant will allow. Might even travel as far as some distant canyon wall, and then bounce back once or twice again. A whisper, though, travels below it all, goes on forever. Thank you. Next, Bruce Geddes.
Thank you, Bruce Coffin. I'd also like to thank Novel Idea. Actually, I'll just say that anybody who anybody else thanks tonight, I thank double. How's that? I am not. I'm the only one here who's not a poet, and so I'm going to read a short story. It's called The Birthing Pool, and just a trigger warning: there is birthing in the birthing pool, so. That's that. Okay. The birthing pool. Nobody else seems to care about the cheese, so Gary Quinn reaches for the knife again. He's thinking brie this time and slides a slab onto a cracker. With all those seeds, those hard flecks of tawny, black and brown, Gary's been iffy about the crackers, but they're pretty tasty. He'll have to remember to ask Francie for the name. But not yet, because Francie's busy. She's in the living room soaking in what they call a birthing pool. By Gary's clock, she's been in there for over an hour, and the contractions are close. Only 4 minutes since the last one. Francie says, "Howoo!" "That's it, baby," Rula says. "You're doing great." Rula's in the pool, too, up to her thighs in the same water that will soon receive their firstborn child. It's been 22 years, but Gary remembers Lydia in the delivery room when Tony arrived, and he knows that when the time comes, the kid won't be the only thing Francie pushes out her belly. He wonders if Rula, in her white tank top and shorts, knows about the mess, if anyone in the birthing pool scene thought to warn her. For the record, Gary had been skeptical from the start. "You're not going to an actual hospital," he said. "Not in your life," Francie said. "Why not?" "It's hardly up to you, Gary," Lydia said. Francie started listing the benefits of underwater birth, buoyancy being a big one. "So that the uterine contractions are more efficient," she said. "Efficient," Gary said. "You're having a baby here, not trying to save a few bucks on the gas bill." But Francie had other reasons. "It improves blood circulation, which means more oxygen for our baby." "Did you hear that, Gary?" Lydia said. "Their baby, not yours." Gary looked to Rula, but Rula was busy massaging Francie's lower back. "Okay, sure, more oxygen. But seriously, in the middle of the living room?" "Of course," Francie said. "The living room is the center of our home. It will be the first of 1,000 memories our family will create here." "So what's one less memory? What's wrong with 999, he said. Then Gary thought about his son, Tony. Certain things he wished he could forget. "And what if it springs a leak?" he said. "That amount of water will do real damage. What about using the garage instead?" "My baby is not sharing the birthing room with a pickup truck," Francie said. "Well, you'd park it on the street, obviously." "It'll be fine," Rula said. "Really, don't you think we've looked into everything? And there's no worries about the baby drowning, is there, Francie? That's the amazing part to me. The kid's already swimming around in all that fluid in the womb, so another few seconds in the pool doesn't make a difference, does it, Francie? And if you don't get every drop of water, you're looking at a potential mold problem," Gary said. "Plus, from what I've heard, a water birth is less painful for the mother," Rula said. "Which is important, right?" "Okay, there it is," thought Gary. "There's a whole reason Rula's on board with this wacky... oops. With his wacky plan. For Francie, she wants everything to be easy." Later, after Lydia drove off to teach her night class, Rula showed up at their back door. It was something she did whenever she craved meat or needed to escape the baby talk. Gary opened beers and made sandwiches with leftover pork roast. And then he said, "I wonder if Tony would have run away if he'd been born underwater." "That doesn't make any sense," Rula said. "I know, but you never know, right? You have to wonder, don't you?" The pool is a big, puffy, inflated thing, sturdy but soft all around. Francie is crowned in a wreath of tiny pink and white flowers. Her face is flushed. Her sweat-damp hair sticks to her forehead. She's bracing for the next contraction. Lydia is there, too, not in the pool, thank God, but on the dry side, stroking Francie's arms with scented oil and whispering calming words into her ear. A couple of months back, after one of their pool birth prep classes, Francie showed up with a bouquet of fresh daisies and asked Lydia to be one of her coaches. Lydia gathered the flowers in her arms and said, "Yes, of course." They hugged, and Francie cried a little, and then a lot. And once she wiped her tears, she asked if it wouldn't be too much trouble if, during the birthing experience, she could call Lydia Mommy. "It would just mean so much to me," Francie said. Then they were both crying. Probably not for the same reason, Gary figured. He thought the whole thing was a bad idea. He said so to Lydia after Francie left. "You don't know what you're getting into." "I think I do," she said. "I helped my sister with the twins, didn't I? That was years ago. And it was a proper hospital where the medicines are stronger than I have neuter or whatever. I'll just be there for support. She has a midwife and a doula. No sorceress? No shawl woman? Really, Gary, why do you care so much? And the whole mommy thing. Her own mother's still alive, for God's sake. It's their choice. I can't refuse her now. But why you?" "Maybe she trusts me," Lydia said. She paused. She knew what she said next would have pointy edges. One mother to another. It was around Tony's 10th birthday that Rula moved in next door. Gary liked her right away. She took terrific care of her front lawn, for one. She seeded, fertilized, rolled, watered regularly, attacked those weeds like a warrior. It was Rula who convinced Gary to buy an edger, a tool he'd always dismissed as excessive. But then edging turned out to be the only chore Tony ever liked, and Gary had to admit, the lawn looked sharper surrounded by clean borders. In summer, Rula barbecued Slovaki sticks, and Gary and Lydia invited her to join their pub trivia team. They still do those trivia nights, but now it's just Gary and Rula. Francie quit. All those questions about the 1980s weren't so much fun for her. Then Lydia used the excuse to bow out. Sometimes Gary and Rula stay late, after trivia's over, to talk politics and movies and sports, repeatedly ordering one more round while lamenting the terrible hangovers they'd have to work through the next day. Gary's job in the whole birthing pool experience is to stay in the kitchen and mind the pots of water on the stove. Apparently, according to Francie, the pool water needs to stay fixed at precisely 38 degrees centigrade. Mm-hmm. He and Lydia aren't the only friends invited to share the moment. Most are strangers to him. One is a youngish woman with silver hoop earrings and a floppy knit cap. She's circling the pool with a video camera. Another, who looks sort of familiar, handles all the music. Choice is pre-approved by Francie, of course. The rest, four in total, stand near the pool amid the warmth and flickering glow of 100 candles. They chant periodically in soothing tones. Rula and Francie married about 4 years back. A May to December situation. Gary gets it. Francie's gorgeous. That reconstituted hippie shit wears well on her. Long, wavy, dirty blonde hair, summery blue eyes, little golden hairs on her arms that pick up the sun at dusk. She's basically the opposite of Rula, who is squat and wide-eyed and looks like a hammerhead shark. Not that he'd ever say so out loud. Rula is a genuinely good person and doesn't know what he would have done without her in those months after Tony ditched. Not only during the days and weeks of fruitless searching, but in the awful empty months and years after they gave up. Without doing anything special, without unsolicited advice or words cribbed from some supermarket shrink, Rula brought some reason back into Gary's life. Just enough, anyway. At the wedding, the guests gathered on a tropical beach at sunset, Rula in a linen shirt with a wood bead necklace, Francie's face decorated with sparkles, a pair of angel's wings dangling from her back. They stared at each other and said a few words, then they asked everyone to follow them into the surf, where Francie and Rula declared their souls combined. A whoop went up, and everyone was invited back to the hotel to dance. Later, Gary brought Rula beer and toasted her happiness. "What'd you think of that ceremony?" Rula asked. "Flake City or what?" "Couldn't tell," Gary said. "Too busy looking out for jellyfish." "That's all right," Rula said. "Worth it." Gary was surprised at how little he doubted her. Now Francie's into another contraction, and the DJ switches to something with more pace, mimicking the beat set by Francie's uterus. Gary wonders about all the incense, if that smoke is what a newborn should be taking with its first breaths. Lydia checks the temperature in the pool, and without looking at him, asks Gary if the pots on the stove are ready. He retreats to the kitchen and checks the thermometers. The low one is at 31, the high at 45. "Everything holding steady at 38, he says. "Just holler when you need me." Francie moans again, low and forcibly controlled like a cow. The midwife shoves her hand in the pool, down towards Francie's cooch. "It won't be long," she says. Rula kisses the back of her wife's neck and rests her forehead against Francie's loosened hair. All that damp love is touching, Gary thinks, especially in front of all these people. She probably doesn't know the words, but Lydia joins in the chanting, and by now, he's sick of these insistent memories, but Lydia's quiet voice reminds Gary of how she used to sing to Tony at night when he got fussy in the crib. Remarkably, Francie is a picture of calm. If she's in pain, she doesn't show it. Her breathing is steady, relaxed. She looks healthy and beautiful. Maybe that birthing pool works after all. On the other hand, Rula is virtually vibrating. She's a strong woman, as steady as anyone Gary knows. But a moment like this tests the nerves. Gary wonders if all his talk about Tony and the things that went so wrong with him, with them, left Rula spooked. He wonders if she's in that pool now, wondering if this new kid will be happy, if this house with its recently restored hardwood, its trimmed and weed-free lawn will be a good place to grow up, if the kid will like school, get along with teachers, make friends and allies so that when the bullies show up, he'll always have a place to go, if she and Francie will be good parents. "Hope for a girl," Gary told her one night after trivia. "It doesn't matter what we get," Rula replied. Of course she'd say that. Who wouldn't? Another push, and the midwife announces the baby's coming. Crowning. Rula presses her lips to Francie's flushed cheek. Lydia, kneeling on the edge of the pool, hooks her fingers around Francie's elbows. "It's okay," she says. "You're doing great. You both are." "Thank you, Mommy," Francie says, and Lydia tries not to, but begins to cry. She looks at Gary, blinking her against her tears. Gary swallows. He feels a little lightheaded. He's glad he's sitting down. He can't really focus, but he's aware of a rush of activity in the pool. The midwife reaches and produces the package from under the water. Slick, purple-red skin like a wet potato. The others gather around, cooing through sighs and tears. The midwife has her finger in the baby's mouth now, clearing out the goo. There's a little cough and then a sharp whine of the world's newest voice. The doula dabs Francie's head with a cloth until Rula resumes the job. Poor woman, she looks ready to collapse. Francie sees the baby and starts to cry, and now pretty much everyone is crying and wrapping their hands around everybody else, coming in to get a closer look in the candlelight. But Gary Quinn can't join them. He's sitting at the kitchen table next to the half-empty cheese plate, staring at his wife, who is still on her knees at the pool's edge. She's turned her head away from Francie and Rula and the others. Her fake blonde hair is matted with steam and sweat, her mouth twisted into something ugly. Gary stares until his love for her and the sadness he feels are too much to hold all at once. And then he stands with his aching and retreats back of the kitchen to turn off the stove if anyone asks. Steam from the lidless pots dampen his face and fog his vision. Now everybody is saying nice things about the newborn, the full head of hair, the adorable toes. But all Gary Quinn can hear is the water in the birthing pool swishing around, overflowing and slapping on the hardwood. You do your best, he thinks. Boy or girl, it doesn't matter. So now my pleasure to introduce the final reader before the break is Nancy.
Yes. I like this podium here. It doesn't throw back to anything, but it makes me feel powerful, churchy. My bio, I'm a poet and a fiction writer, and this is my fourth collection of poetry. I've published a novel and a collection of short stories, and I'm just going to read from this book, which came out 2 years ago now, I believe. And I'm going to read a couple of new poems, too. I'm working on a new project. The first poem is called Non Sequitur. I'm studying unease with the natural world. Western blackleg tick, Rocky Mountain wood tick, deer tick, all shifty little nightmares. Speaking of man's fall, I am a fan of apples, abundant and waxy world travelers, dropped from tree to produce departments at $2.49 a pound. I wouldn't say I'm ashamed of my nakedness, of my careworn body. I can still bite into the fruit of good and evil. Hey, man, I can still get it up. But I'm as clear as I've ever been about love, whatever the fuck love is, while worry creeps along my body in search of a tender peace. I have no idea what's coming next. Sometimes I laugh. Sometimes I just go bonkers. I do not have the success habit, that one thing I can do. Trouble likes to nestle behind ears and under armpits and in our groins where, the story goes, all sin originated. Oh, wicked boxes of delight. FYI, vanilla is a difficult food. Fruit of the hand, pollinated, orchid, really. Shouldn't we all reach into our beloveds just so? I don't want your father's forgiveness. I have the gift of her pocket knife. I want her and our bodies rolling away from one another in the summer heat. I'm going to read this poem. I feel like I read it any time I'm at. Novel idea, but I can't help myself. I guess I like it. Glorious bitches. Once your boyfriend squeezed into our living room through the window we left open just wide enough for the cat. 35 years later, he rings into this present moment, unbidden. Though we're not on mushrooms, and being there is not on the late movie, and we have free cross-country calling, and we can no longer party like we used to, and I've put in my hearing aids, so the tone of your beloved voice is clear. It seems impossible that we are no longer those young women with a taste for the extreme, as if pain was truer than peace, and only knuckleheads settled for the quiet life. LOL, right? Those losses we collected like thrift store cowboy boots until we finally submitted to the daydream of motherhood. Such a wicked surprise, that monotony. How suddenly we were so fucking boring, so tired, so disappointed, so undesirable, so undesiring. We are always returned to our miscalculations. And now your fragile old boyfriend is crawling back through time, inserting himself through the looping monster of the internet, literally crazy as a loon, as our mothers would have said. His boundaries as shite as ever. But for the moment, we become glorious bitches and we laugh at the damages, his and ours. What were we ever thinking? Then you give me a brief rundown on sativa and indica, because don't we deserve some relief? Didn't we raise our children, all the while our hearts pounding in our throats, those delicate disasters we cannot shrug off, only to find we have failed as bigly as our own mothers, and our ex-lovers are old or dead or mad. I guess this book is a lot about grief, and some of that grief is for being not young anymore, and some of that grief is for all the people that have died by now in my life, but this one is a not young one. a thing on beauty. But maybe taking some fun at myself, I hope. Mm-hmm. Think of collagen as scaffolding for your face, and every time you consume sugar, you remove a piece of that scaffolding. And as collagen breaks down and becomes destroyed, wrinkles begin to appear, and you are left without the qualities that are typical of beauty. As you consume sugar, the scaffolding of your good looks crumble. Then the messy state of your soul becomes ripped, bold across your face. You now, without the qualities that are typical of beauty, find your individual unit of capital is no longer in demand. The messy state of your soul is written boldly across your face. You crave too often, and you are devoted to eating. Your individual unit of capital is no longer in demand, and women have been burned for less than that hair on your chin. You surrender to craving too often, plus you are devoted to eating. Your collagen is being destroyed, and the wrinkles. Women have been burned for less than that hair on your chin and other stories. Try not to think of collagen, the scaffolding for your face. Mm-hmm. Talking head. Once I was the source, all fountain, all legs, gone now the joy of lighting myself on fire, of running headlong into calamity, my kingdom for a pair of comfortable heels. My body is ever the enemy, ill-fated as the socialist project in the Parliament of Greed. Still, each year the birds get drunk on summer. And like us, we who invented love, us bipeds with our roaring cunts, us idiots of desire, us fat drunks, the birds, beloved of the trees, return, as we must also return to what we've lost, to our mums, to our bodies, and to the earth. I did this really great project when I first moved to Toronto in 2008-09, and I was hooked up with a visual artist who was doing video. It was through LIFT, the society. It was a nonprofit film society. And the artist's name is Nouriel Stern, and she has an amazing imagination. And somebody in her art program had scrapbooks from the first lunar landing. Didn't want to keep them. They gave them to her. So we did this project together, and she made this great little film that kind of goes all scattered, and we used microfiche. She was just so smart. I just wrote the poem. She did everything about it. That's amazing. And I'm really proud to have had a piece in this. Anyway, this is called The History of Exploration, and I wrote this from the newspaper articles in the scrapbook. My mother was ironing the sheets, blue ironing board, wicker basket. The drapes were drawn, and it was boring in that room. I don't know where my brothers were. Or I'm confusing this with Bobby Kennedy's murder and the Technicolor news flashing in black and white on the TV screen in Peace Country. But for sure, my mother stood by the hot iron, and the sheets had been on the line, and the Armstrong boy held his hand to his face. I didn't see the lunar module or the man. I saw my mother in the long shadow of laundry and ground beef. Pay attention, she said. History is in the making, like the heirs of Philippa Columbus, with their freshly coiffed hair made do with gobs of coffee. Joan Aldrin, cigarette in hand, turned away from the TV. The stars had warned against throwing caution to the wind. My mother folded each white sheet into a square, stirred powdered milk and sugar into her Sanka, held a match to the tip of her Rothmans. In 40 years, it would all be forgotten. The white sheets, the landing, the cheerful wives and anxious children. But the cliché moon, diminished by electric streetlights, continued its ordinary orbit. And my mother cried out, sweet Jesus, to no one in particular. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to read three new poems now. Newer poems. That are part of a large project or larger project that I have no control over right now. And I suppose focus and time is part of that. But anyway, this is called Geography. And also, I worked on sonnets a lot. That's kind of what got me back. I hadn't written poems for about 10 years, and then I started writing sonnets. And so these I think of as a kind of sonnet, but they're prose poems. But basically, I've broken them into two paragraphs of 8 and 6, and I try and do a turn, but they're really sloppy sonnets. But I like to think of that just to contain the poem, so they look like a prose piece, but they're sonnet E. Geography. Back in the day when a dime bag was four fingers full of seeds that burned perfect O's in our floral print shirts and blouses and in our knitted Fentex vests, and we hit that shit then passed out while we listened to Pink Floyd and Supertramp, there were no women. There were ladies, there were girlfriends, there was pussy, and the rest of us were girls. This is heteronormativity 101 and does not account for the strange queers who nobody admitted to fucking. This is high school. This is also the geography that blooded you. Let me tell you, a person took their chances on edibles in those days. This leads to the point, who doesn't want to believe in change? Now even the Christians will refer to a woman as Ms. Now ladies and girlfriends, pussies and girls, women and NBs, and even men can be considered fuckable. Of course, you may ask yourself, to whom are these people fuckable? And the answer to that question is investors. Investors who look to the future and believe in returns and gains. Investors who have ushered in the new dawn of technology. Oh, what a beautiful new age we live in. Now we can microdose our THC. Soon we will be able to colonize the moon. This poem is called NASA's James Webb Telescope Reveals Emerging Stellary. I'll just slow down and start over. The title is almost the first line in the poem. NASA's James Webb Telescope reveals emerging stellar nurseries. Meanwhile, the dog is working on a poem possibly titled Bone Marrow on a Tongue. The dog carries her poem between her teeth. The dog experiments with punctuation, snapping mosquitoes out of the air and black flies. The dog sits at the window, perhaps associating her poem's own constructedness with the shepherdoodle leashed to a human hand, with the long stretches of sidewalk, like and unlike the Dominican sand. Of course, it's doubtful the dog considers constructedness, even her own, not even her own. Children ask, is your dog a boy or a girl? Unaware in that moment that she is being mediated, the dog exposes her belly to the children. She wears a green collar and her name is Ranger. And I say she is a good dog and people say, oh, she is a girl. There's a very delicate balance between sparking star formation and stopping it. The dog endures the car. The dog endures the canoe. The dog emerged from the jet's hold with caution, then stared out the car window on the drive to her new home, which could as well have been NGC 3244 in the Carina Nebula as a backyard in Kingston, Ontario. And now the dog's teeth scrape against the bone, searching for the essential part, that soft, highly vascular, modified connective tissue. And I am characterizing the dog, whom I call she out of habit, as a creature not concerned with gender, certain I have found the animal essence of the dog. My last poem is a few questions for the dog. We lost our dear friend Henry on Tuesday. He was part of our dog pack, but not part of my immediate dog family, but still, he's like my nephew dog. We said goodbye to him on Tuesday, and so I'm going to read this poem in his honor. A few questions for the dog. Have I been gone for 10 minutes, or have matter and energy curved the fabric of space-time? What are the wide-ranging consequences of the relativity of time, or specifically, what is now? Were those 10 minutes more like sitting with a pretty girl, or more like sitting in the government service office waiting for your number to be called? If the aggregate of all positions of any individual particle that retains its identity exists simultaneously on something like a string, do we look like a bowl of spaghetti in the eyes of God? And also about God, true or false? Fuck, marry, or kill? Squirrel, rabbit, or ginger cat? Would you like me to give you something to bark about? What will we do when our atoms disassemble? How will that energy be repurposed? Will all the photons that ever bounced off our bodies dash off like children? Will we continue to echo throughout space until time is spread as thin as dust? Who's a good dog? Who's a good dog? Oh, who's a good doggy? Mm.
We're going to take a break now, right?
Take a short break. Please don't leave.
Two more readers.
Okay. So yeah, okay, well, we'll get started again for our last couple of readings. Thanks again for coming. I just wanted to reiterate as well, in case it wasn't clear, that books from all of the readers tonight are for sale up here on the table, right up here. So I think, Nancy, you have two up here for sale. There's Canary and three. Nothing Will Save Your Life, and all three, and the Western Alienation Merit Badge, and then, yeah, so on and so forth. So there's books from everybody. And so, and yeah, I'll hand it over to our next reader, Sadiqa, and she can introduce herself, right?
Thank you. Thanks. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for coming. It's been so good so far. Okay, I'm Sadiqa Ademeyer. I have poetry on the desk here and a memoir, and I'm poet laureate of Kingston. I'm going to read an essay, though.
The Governor General Award-winning memoir.
Yeah.
thank you. This is... I'm working on a book of essays, so this is an excerpt from one of them. And I was thinking about the idea of birthplaces. So I was born in Amsterdam, but then my family, we moved away before I was like a year and a half. So I lived there for a really short time, and I don't remember that period. But I really love the city, and I have often questioned for myself whether I could claim any kind of real connection to it that goes deeper than just being a visitor there. And because we all, most of us, live away from where we were born at this point, I thought it's also sort of an interesting case study to think about birthplaces and what they mean in our lives. So I went back in November and I looked around. Here's a part of my report. At home, a map of Amsterdam was on my bedroom wall. The downtown, a spider's web of streets and alleys and wharves and canals strung from the A, water that was once the westerly digression of a sea. Now I was looking at the loosely anchored strands of a web in a ceiling corner, inside the former home for widows and orphans, in Amsterdam itself. The spider seemed pregnant. I'd boarded a plane in the evening and landed at sunrise. A lens had scanned and recognized my face. Then came a train aisle jammed with suitcases, a fat rainbow over the varnished harbor, an electronic ticket for a biofuel bus, directions dispensed in the neighborhood's accent. Yeah, the sloped man with the scarred chin said, that's right where I live. Go back across this bridge, at my street hang a left, turn after the tobacco shop. It's a laundromat now. The building had a courtyard that was overgrown. Red tricycle in the hallway, notice of a tenant meeting, an injured umbrella. A bookshelf with the same book I'd been reading on the flight. Three children, daughters of the people who had given me the keys, bounced on the narrow bed. I left to stay awake. Brick-walled flats and houses, street names mounted on their corners, portal walls of Ottoman tiles. An Ethiopian coffee shop where the owner lit a candle on the single table and murmured a prayer. Flower stand, fish market, traffic circle, a merry-go-round of bikes. I started to breathe with the breath of the city again. Old breeds of apples and smoked sausage, and the sugared anise that is served on rusks for the birth of a child. Gulls carving through November fog. The tiredness that moved in like a wall of fog. I woke up, and Amsterdam was still outside the window. I mistook it for daylight, the street light. I lifted the curtain and saw a passing cluster of children who carried lanterns on sticks. We didn't live here for long. Two winters of snowflakes quietly extinguished on the dark green skin of the Noorderamstel Canal. It did snow then. Of Amsterdam as home, I would, if I spoke Turkish, use the heard past tense, a conjugation for conveying what we never witnessed or do not recall, like fiction or early childhood. Turkish is a common language in the city. There are shops with fresh pide, baklava, doner, shawarma when transliterated into Dutch. There's no meat on the spit, so I get the fries in a paper cone. The owner converses with a friend who drinks tea from a glass mug, and the only word I understand is Palestine. To white residents, I often look Turkish, but not to the Turkish Dutch themselves. In another restaurant, the waiter addresses me for a moment in Indonesian. When I give the bookstore clerk a copy of my book, she grins and says, "Your last name is True Amsterdam." I stay the same, and I'm a shapeshifter here, moving in and out of real and imagined belonging. Amsterdam is a dense stream of motions that culminates and elapses again on this November morning in a sweat-soaked dance rehearsal glimpsed through a factory window, itself a mosaic of fractures across which the clouds move. When you live here, your gestures are no longer yours alone. Whatever you do becomes part of a nine-century project called Amsterdam. Former squats, narrow alleys, judiciously expansive trees. Amsterdam sees me mirrored fluctuantly in the water as I lean over a short arched bridge that wears its name on the cast iron railing. The heron, who once spotted two lost men in a swamp and instructed them to found the sodden settlement, is watching from the moss roof of a houseboat, her graphite feathers slightly ragged from the rain. "Your hamlet," she told them, "will grow into a city that will rule the world." Posts were driven into the fen as foundation. 13,681 of them still hold up the palace. If that city ever fell over, who would pay for that? The nursery rhyme leaves the question hanging, but the answer is pervasive as the damp. Peanut sauce on French fries, coffee with a cinnamon wafer, a tall ship named Amsterdam, docked by the museum, flying a limp East India Company flag. I wander through the Oosterpark, past brown ducks adrift on the pond, and find the National Slavery Monument. The work is by artist Erwin de Vries. I shift my weight to stay warm. What doesn't feel right is the posture of the woman representing freedom. She stands with her legs leaning forward, her spine bent so far back that I feel the strain. Her shape is a slingshot pulled past breaking. I walk, and under my soles are the city pavements, and under them, the hidden infrastructure of its circulations, and under those, its ancient fortifications, rusted ship chains, powdered stone ledgers. On the Albert Cup, I meet an old man in a beautifully disheveled suit who asks me in Suriname Dutch for a euro. He stares at the ground while I search my bag. Then he murmurs, "Such lovely shoes, they grace your feet." To claim this city as my own is to harbor a turbulent knowledge in my body. Boatloads of people paid for Amsterdam with the substance of their lives. In Banda Aceh, Lampung, Saramaca, Tshwane, Manhattan, in places whose original names are unknown to me because their maps, as if in a nightmare where every figure is a self, are covered in my own language. You breathe your first breath there. Droplets of canal water are in it, ancient brick dust, down of a heron's breast. With that gulp of particular air, you make your first sound, a rip in the veil between worlds. Your eyes open, and they are unfinished. The cells that read color and light will awaken slowly. For months, they will absorb the luminosities of clouds, the fractured glare of snow, the blooming inkblots of spring in the park, the grays and browns of an interior. And they will calibrate themselves accordingly. You could already hear, but what you received was viscous, elliptical, submerged, and now the room sounds rouse you with their clarity and range. Does the azan that your father sings in your ears become your first music? Or did the ding of the streetcar bell barge in? It doesn't matter. Here is one unified field. You were held inside someone, and you want her to hold you again in this bright spaciousness. Your blood is your own now. There was a hole in your heart, and it shuts But whatever spirits dwell in this place, outside the peripheries of the senses, they had a chance to come in.
Thanks, Zvika. Thanks for coming, guys. I'm on a little tour for this book, and like I said, was really looking forward to arriving and reading in Kingston. So this is the first time I've been in this bookstore, and really the first time I've been in Kingston as well. So it's been lovely so far, so thank you so much. A Horse at the Window is my third book, but what the heck is it? So as I've explained to some people before, it to me, as a manuscript, it was a book of poetry. It's a book of prose poetry, in fact, so it's like big blocks of text. And I submit this to Anansi, and they got back to me and said that the poetry list was full for many years. So that was kind of like a preamble to a no. Right? Like, here's the good news, we're doing good. But through some miracle, they liked the book, and they said, well, would you be okay with it coming out as a book of fiction? Like under our fiction imprint. And I said, like, you can call it a piece of shit. I don't care what you call it. That sounds really amazing to me. So here we are. So it's, as it says on the, they wrote on the back, these are basically dramatic monologues as they're being a reference. So elements of prose poem, faux memoir, online diatribe, and philosophical investigation. So hopefully there's something in it for you. And yeah, I encourage you to come up, take a look at all the books that are available. And one more thing as I'm talking about this book briefly. I'm happy about this because, like with my last book, I do something with local charities. So royalties for this book are donated to Fred Victor, which is a social service charity in Toronto that helps people experiencing homelessness. And something very, talking to you, Nancy, a little bit about dogs, a little bit, is that Fred Victor allows people experiencing homelessness to bring their pets into the shelter, mm-hmm. which really pulled on my heartstrings. So I was like, well, they're the ones to donate to. So, yeah, thank you so much for coming out. I'm going to read two of these things from the book. Yeah. Thanks so much. So this first piece is called Reasons for My Success. I was not nice. I was not nice enough. I was not nice enough to the right people. My niceness was too casual. My niceness was designed for acquaintances, and so it had no lasting impact. I carried out acts of niceness too long ago for people to remember today, and too long ago for those distributing acts of niceness now. I forgot the intention behind my niceness, and so grew weary of niceness in all its forms. I was not nice consistently or deliberately in public, and so withdrew my general fit-for-acquaintances style niceness, a quality ready for all comers, to a shrinking circle of people I really did care about, for whom I could maintain the energy required of niceness, and for whom my niceness changed its character, becoming intimate or something else not quite nice at all. My acts of niceness were spotty. When I attempted acts of niceness in public, I felt strange and inauthentic with increasing intensity. My acts of niceness cowed me. I felt hot and ashamed for my expressions of niceness, especially when these expressions were not acknowledged by their recipients. I felt expressing niceness made the objects of my niceness uncomfortable occasionally, or made these people for whom I was expressing niceness turn against me and categorize me as not nice. The people for whom I performed niceness were the wrong people, insofar as they are no longer in positions to perform public acts of reciprocal niceness. Or they're not accustomed to expressing private acts of niceness, or they feel no need to reciprocate niceness, at least not to me, or to those like me, to people in my predicament. I failed to understand that I was not and am not deserving of niceness, per se, or period.
I failed to account for all the terrible things I said out loud and in private, often while intoxicated and happy, thinking I was sharing niceness. For the wasted years of my life when being nice was of fundamental importance. My acts of niceness, no longer public or consistent, made others believe I did not wish to receive acts of niceness myself, that I was somehow above or uninterested in public acts of niceness, when in truth I craved them desperately. I was furthermore not nice in sufficient public and private ways to people who interpreted my acts of niceness to certain distasteful people as problematic. I was nice to people who are today irrelevant to public consideration. I was also nice to people who are not fit recipients from public niceness, to whom extending niceness was an ethical breach or a sign that my niceness was too fluid or generous, despite my niceness being merely of a casual passing nature, as mentioned. I was not nice enough to people who believe niceness must be parceled out judiciously to those who, by fact of their relationship or discipline or social standing, are more deserving of public or private acts of niceness than others, regardless of the overall volume of niceness being expressed. I was not nice enough to those who, through some history of being hurt or abused, consider their own niceness a limited resource. I failed to be eligible to receive niceness from those who feel acts of niceness are made primarily for public consumption on momentous occasions and for a select group only. I was paradoxically too nice to make a fuss about those who are not nice to me or to others with whom I held acquaintance or even friendship. I failed to reveal my private sense of injustice or hypocrisy, cruelty or betrayal in a public setting, and thus was categorized as someone who was not nice, though less not nice than if I had expressed the full storm of my emotional life, as then I would have been not nice to a much more damaging, irreparable extent. And I failed to grasp how others could be nice in public to people they deemed problematic or not nice or insufficiently deserving in private, and thus I refrained from expressing niceness to those by whom I was betrayed systematically. I failed to grasp that acts of niceness made in person are of lesser quality than public acts of niceness made from a great distance and with far less intimacy. My niceness had limitations fit to my disposition and imaginary sense of self-worth. I failed to sustain the energy necessary for daily, weekly acts of niceness due to my body's aging, that stated sense of inauthenticity, a general weariness born of failed applications and unnumbered rejections, the demands of dull and pitiless work, and the emptiness of public gestures. Resigning myself to not being nice, or being deemed not nice, or not especially deserving of niceness, felt nice, bizarrely, but only for a few months, after which I again felt it would be nice to feel included in the worldly public exchange of niceness. But by then it was too late to re-enter with the same enthusiasm or trust I had felt when younger, and less experienced with the vagaries of being nice. To measure my lack of suitability to receive niceness from others, I compiled a voluminous list of every person with whom I'd shared an acquaintance, correspondence, and/or friendship, then wrote 3 to 7 reasons beside each in sharp bullet points why each person might not be nice to me. Why they would not extend niceness to me, and why I might deserve this withholding of niceness. This list included those who were closest to me, those who had extended niceness to me in the past, and why they had stopped doing so, and those who had never expressed niceness to me in the first place, and why this was the case and would continue to be so. The work of this list was decidedly not nice, loaded with shameful revelations and remembrances, though it felt nice in the same way a spanking feels nice, or a candlelit confession, or chores, or a punishment, or a sentence. The way a failing grade feels nice, or a reprimand at work. The way a traffic ticket or a dressing down by a superior feels nice. But it did not stop me from trying to think of newer, nicer things I could do for people to vindicate myself in their eyes and be the subject or object of nice expressions once again. Where I was headed with this list was a concrete feeling of not niceness in my chest and a not nice urge to sob. This list became my vocation, my sole hobby, which replaced my older hobbies and vocational activities that were, to my chagrin, bound up in dense, complex feelings of equilibrium, fairness, and withheld niceness. And so charged my nights, after my not nice work was finished, with a sense of purpose.